court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Maritime Overseas versus Kelly.
May it please the court, Ms. Linda Brooks will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 6 minutes of rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case presents this court with the issue of the proper standard to be used by courts of appeal in reviewing the factual sufficiency of damage evidence. A damage evidence would support a verdict and rest upon medical and scientific testimony.
Evidence which did not object at trial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you also about that statement. You say to review the factual sufficiency, and let's get this issue on the way. You wanting us to review the factual sufficiency or the legal sufficiency?
No, Your Honor. We are asking that you review the standard that's applied by the Court of Appeals in reviewing the factual sufficiency of the evidence. And indeed, the factual sufficiency of this evidence has been reviewed under two different standards already. One by the initial panel of the Court of Appeals, which reviewed the factual sufficiency of the evidence according to a proper standard in accordance with the principles that were ultimately announced in Daubert and adopted by this court in Robinson versus DuPont and Havner versus Merrill Dow.
Mr. Brooks, help me to understand how we can get to that issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you did not object to trial, and the way to preserve error is by objection.
The way to preserve error on factual sufficiency is through a motion for new trial according to Rule 324. And according to this rule, this court's many opinions, including the Cecil case. And that is indeed what we did. We filed a timely motion for new trial that absolutely laid out our problem, which was we were objecting to the lack of any causative link between diazinon and delayed neurotoxicity, which is what this jury found in awarding over $8 million in damages. So we clearly met our burden of preserving error and bringing it to this court.
Is your position that you have to have to prove up damages in this case, you have to have both not only the expert testimony that there was a Cosby deal, but you've got to have evidence in the record that justifies the opinion that gets expressed?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe
and your
that that's
your complaint is that they did not do a review of the evidence underlying the opinion. They just accepted the opinion as the evidence.
No, Your Honor. Both courts of appeals did review the same evidence. They both reviewed the same evidence, but with two different standards in mind. One looked to see whether or not, in accordance with the principles of this court is now espoused in Havner, whether or not there was a reliable scientific basis upon which those experts could express those naked conclusions of reasonable medical probability.
And in that regard, with regard to Havner and with regard to most every other case that discusses that issue, isn't that analysis applied to determine whether or not, as you say, there is an adequate scientific basis for the admissibility of the evidence? In other words, and that goes to what we frame as the gatekeeping function of the courts, okay? But that is separate from what we're dealing with in this case, which is not a gatekeeping, because the evidence got past the gate and into the courtroom. And so isn't this analysis that you're asking us to make different from the Havner analysis?
We believe it's very similar to the Havner analysis, Your Honor, since the Havner analysis is a no evidence, and did review the evidence as opposed to determining whether or not it was admissible. We believe that the central inquiry is the same, which is the scientific reliability of scientific testimony that's presented from expert testimony.
So are you saying that there are two different time periods in which a reviewing court can determine whether or not the evidence was scientifically reliable? First and foremost, before the evidence is ever put on at the witness stand, you review it, you can engage in that gatekeeping function. And then, once you get past the gate and into the courtroom and into the jury box, on appeal, you can once again review the evidence to determine whether or not it was scientifically reliable.
Yes, Your Honor, and in fact, we believe that Havner recognized that in pointing out that the expert testimony in that case had been partially objected to. Some of the expert testimony had been objected to, but there was other expert testimony that came in without objection, And the petitioners in Havner certainly challenged all of that expert testimony, the weight of all of that testimony, whether or not that was any evidence whatsoever to support a verdict. In fact, this court recognized in both Robinson and in Havner that just because evidence comes in without objection, such as Justice Gonzalez's submission of the moon made of green cheese and the earth flat, if that evidence comes in without objection, it does not somehow imbue it with some sort of great weight. The weight of the evidence still must be weighed. The Texas Constitution provides that Texas Courts of Appeals have a duty to weigh the evidence, the factual sufficiency of the evidence, regardless of what.
So it's your argument that they did not weigh the evidence?
They did not weigh the evidence according to the proper standard which has been announced by this court.
Who is they? They who?
The 14th Court of Appeals sitting on bonds, Your Honor.
If your complaint here is all an improper factual sufficiency standard,
yes,
how come the primary relief you asked for in your latest brief is a new trial? I didn't see anything in the brief that points to the justification for it.
The justification is the fact that there have been these two contrasting weighings of the evidence already, Your Honor, these two contrasting evaluations of the evidence already, according to two separate
standards. So it's just too hard, let's start over?
I'm sorry?
So it's too hard, let's start over at zero, or?
Well, no, we think that certainly the remedy for insufficiency would be a new trial.
Which we can't.
We understand that you cannot rule on the factual insufficiency of the evidence. However, the original panel of the Court of Appeals undertook a very extensive factual sufficiency review under a standard that was proper, that was consistent with the principles that ultimately got announced in Daubert and in Robinson and Havner. Given the fact that thorough factual sufficiency review has already been undertaken, we certainly think that in the interest of justice that this court could remand directly to the trial.
Do you have any authority where we can, or where the U.S. Supreme Court has held that, can we hold that a panel decision was a mistake and that an en banc decision was a mistake and reinstate a panel decision in an area over which we have no direct jurisdiction?
Well, certainly it would be proper, Your Honor, for this case to go back to the 14th Court of Appeals for a redetermination of the issue according to standards announced by this court.
Do you see any other judgment out of this court on your arguments other than we simply remand it to the Court of Appeals for reconsideration?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Do you see any other judgment coming out of this court on the points of error that you've raised other than we'll simply send it back to CA and have them reconsider?
Certainly. We can see a judgment that would remand to the 14th Court of Appeals with instructions.
But under no circumstances, based on the points you raised here, would this court be free to render a judgment?
No, we do not believe that a judgment
this
can
is
be
This is simply a remand.
This is simply a remand, yes, Your Honor.
Now, in your argument, you're saying you can see that you can see there is some evidence of a causal link.
No, Your Honor, we don't concede that.
But you are not arguing that this is a no evidence point.
The reason that we're not, Your Honor, is that there is some evidence of acute injury, short-term injury, related to exposure to diazinon. What we are claiming is that there isn't sufficient evidence, and we don't believe that there's any, but our argument is that there's insufficient evidence to link diazinon with delayed neurotoxicity.
The argument is made that the federal standard is so weak that it doesn't permit of a no-evidence review.
Of an insufficiency review, Your Honor?
Of a no-evidence review, not a factual insufficiency, but of a no-evidence review.
The standard under the Jones Act, is that what Your Honor is referring to?
I guess I'm asking, could you present, assuming we have the Jones Act standard, assume we even say it's a featherweight level, would there not still have been a no-evidence complaint that could be made in this case?
We believe that that would have been very difficult, Your Honor, given the fact that there was evidence of some injury, there's evidence that the employer's negligence played some part in causing some injury. It's the particular injury to which we object and to which we say that there really was no evidence of any causal link. For this particular injury, as opposed to the separate acute injuries, the two injuries are two separate things.
I think I understand you're saying they showed he had some injury, but not this injury that was caused by the Tylenol. But you're saying under the federal, under the record in this case, there is, you could not bring a no evidence complaint.
That's the way we fought it, probably.
And the only issue you have before this court is whether or not the featherweight standard applies to not only the existence of an injury, but to the causal nexus between the agent complained of causing the injury and, in fact, the injury. You're saying the featherweight standard applies to that as well?
No. We're saying that the featherweight standard applies to the proof of an injury, proof of some injury, that there are causative causation factors involved, both in the liability determination, as reflected in the special issues that were submitted in this case. A causal component of liability, did the maritime overseas negligence cause injury, and is negligence in any way cause injury? Then there's a separate inquiry, a separate causation inquiry in the damages issue, which asks whether or not the jury finds by preponderance of the evidence damages that were caused, damages caused by the occurrence in question.
And you're saying that's a preponderance of the evidence standard.
Absolutely.
That applies to the damages.
Absolutely.
And we should have two kinds of questions. Do we have, was there negligence? Was there an approximate cause of injury? And then, was there a proximate cause of a specific injury?
No, Your Honor, we're not saying that at all. We're saying that the jury issues that they were submitted to this particular jury absolutely embodied the standards and the burdens of proof that we're applying in this case. The first one, which was the negligence issue, and I've got them here, is at page 13 of the transcript, Your Honor. The first question says, was Maritime Overseas Corporation negligent on any of the occasions in question, and did such negligence play any part, even the slightest, in producing injury or illness for Richard Ellis? That was question one. That was the liability question. Of course, it does ask about causation in this question. It's a global negligence and causation question right there. Question
number. And you have no problem with that?
I have no problem with that.
Okay.
Question number six, because there was some evidence that there were acute injuries as opposed to the delayed permanent secondary injuries. The question number six was, what sum of money do you find from a preponderance of the evidence would fairly and reasonably compensate Richard Ellis for the injuries and or illnesses resulting from the occurrence in question? Again, a causation inquiry to the jury of, do you find that the negligence that caused an occurrence, what were the particular injuries that were caused by this occurrence? And that this court in CompuGraphic Corp. versus Morgan, which this court has recently again cited in the Burroughs versus Cry case, recognized the two separate causation factors, one in liability and one in the damages inquiry. In that case, which is a, as the court knows, was a default judgment case, the plaintiff, who had been exposed to toxic fumes, said, I've got a default judgment on liability. I don't have to prove causation of these particular injuries. The court found that that was absolutely incorrect.
So the only thing you're asking the court to do is to say that the Court of Appeals need to do a review based on a preponderance of the evidence on the damages issue, and they failed to do so, and we just need to send it back and tell them to do it that way.
Absolutely.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Eugene Cook, the argument for the respondent.
May it please this honorable court, I need to take a minute to put this matter in perspective, because in 32 years I've never seen a case quite like this. That's why I want this minute to do it. From day one, a law student is taught timely objection, specific objections. I want to look at those objections, first of all, so that you fully understand the strategy which the defense took. Five expert witnesses on causation. Their testimony. 637 pages of testimony. Nine objections. Okay. Nine objections. Five of the objections were that the testimony was non-responsive. Three of the objections were that the questions were leaked. And one was that the witness was testifying from a document, not an evidence. This is the type of objections. Never once the objections which you would expect to hear. Not once. Now, did this big, bad, mean trial judge, Judge Harrison, did he gang up on this defense lawyer and beat him up and intimidate him? Well, of the nine objections, and remember, they're non-responsive leading in the document, not in evidence. Of those nine objections, Judge Harrison sustained counsel on six of them and ruled against Mr. Ellis. All the lawyer had to do was object. Let me take you very quickly now to the next step. The instructed verdict or directed verdict. I have it right here. He moved for instructed verdict on maintenance and cure. Did he move for instructed verdict on liability, on causation? Did not. Did not. The charge. This is the single greatest area in a trial where you have reversible error. And the charge is just so critical. Yet here is the charge for this very important case. And we're talking about four pages. Four pages. Now let's look at this charge. With respect to causation or liability, whatever the trial counsel's strategy was, he didn't object. He didn't object to the charge. He said, I object to liability question number one because it is duplicitous of number two, and I object to number two because it is duplicitous of number one, and that's all he said on causation. On damages, nothing. Whatever strategy they had, they carried it through the entire case. Next step in the trial, motion for new trial, remittitor, JNOV. Liability and causation. Here we are at a key point in time. What do they say about liability and causation? Nothing. They stand there moot. They've got this multi-page motion, which is really three motions in one, and they don't even mention it. What they do say is there is a factual insufficiency on damages, and there is no evidence on damages.
But isn't that their argument?
Sir?
Isn't that their argument that there were some damages here, but not...
Oh, they admit there were some damages.
Not, but not this extent.
But there is... Let's take Rule 104A, okay? which is a rule that everyone knows. And this is the pre-admissibility rule. And Rule 104A talks about preliminary questions concerning qualification of a witness, existence of privilege, admissibility of an evidence shall be determined by the judge. They ignored Rule 104A. Here was the opportunity for them to test their theories, to see if they're valid, and they just totally ignored it. Now, for the court to write otherwise today, we're going to have a problem here with Rule 705, disclosure of facts or data underlying an expert opinion. Because Rule 705 says the expert may testify in terms of opinion or inference and give his reasons, therefore, without prior disclosure of the underlying facts. Well, you've got to object, and they never object. The truth is they have waived. They have waived it at every step. Their arguments today before you are stated in terms of damages. And that's because that's the only time they bother to say factual information.
Let me try to get where we are. There's no question if we just are talking about a simple garden variety automobile intersection case, you don't have to object to factual insufficiency until after the trial. In fact, that's all you can get.
You can't get a new trial. I mean, you can't get a judgment. All you can get is a new trial, right? I mean, and you bring that up at the time of motion for new trial. That's the first time you need mention it. You're saying here that something more needed to be mentioned because this is a more complicated area. Is that right?
Fine.
And if we have a Havner scheme,
where it's not brought up until this stage, it will, the trial will be waived. Am I understanding that correctly?
I'm saying they've waived it. And I'm saying the only part
but,
that
but
they...
But why have they have waived it because of the complexity of the issues here? Or is there something in the rule that says you really can't wait until after the trial's over to bring up insufficiency points?
One of the things that causes me to think that they, to believe that they've waived it is this is a Jones Act case. The burden standard is featherweight. Okay? And Havner, I think, is creating additional burdens. And when we talk about it, we're going under federal substantive law. And I think that Havner is creating problems that are infringing and creating additional burdens on Mr. Ellis. I think Havner also, as you know, GE versus Joyner is going to be heard by the United States Supreme Court, addressing the question of, is there an overlapping now between methodology and conclusions? And I think that's one of the problems with Havner, is that there is, and the two are merging there. But I think that Havner creates burdens under the Jones Act for Mr. Ellis that federal law will not allow.
Why is that?
I think that federal law will not allow the person to ignore each stage of the trial and wait till the very end and attempt to lay behind the law.
Is there a case like that?
Your Honor, we will see about finding one. One of the things that counsel pointed out in her argument...
Well, let me try to clarify this. Are you saying that in any Jones Act case, you might have to make a motion about insufficiency of evidence prior to the time of the trial? Or are you saying in a Jones Act case that involves scientific evidence?
Scientific. We're in a totally new area. The quality of the evidence, I'd like to address that for just a second. You know, when they ignored the 702 type hearing, the 702 type hearing, as this court has pointed out, in that hearing, you get witness qualification, you get reliability, and you get relevance of the dog-bear fit. Okay? They ignored that. All they're up here on today is on damages. And we were always taught that there are four elements in a TARD: duty, violation of duty, damages, and proximate cause. And they are only up here on damages. All the rest of it is through. I don't think...
Well, you know, the argument is causation. I mean,
yes, but
as the panel decision noted, as to each expert, none of them testified this particular toxic substance caused the delayed toxicity reaction or injury.
Justice Gonzalez, you're right as far as it goes, but you are right as far as what you've said. But I'd like to address that if I could for a minute. We're talking about diisonon. Okay. You can... this person was in diazinon in a level that was 100 to 200 times the normal strength. They've admitted he has short-term damages. They just don't want to admit the larger term because of the... But diazinon is an organophosphate. Their logic is, well, the body has organophosphates in it, but, gee, that, you know, you've got a syllogism here that's not correct. Diazinon is an organophosphate insecticide. It is an insecticide. It was designed to kill, whether it is used on rats, on roaches, on animals, or on human beings. But if you realize that it is an insecticide, not just an organophosphate, and you look at what the experts did say, there were epi studies, and the epi studies covered parathion, which is probably the most dangerous of the organophosphate insecticides. There is no way you're ever going to get epi studies on diazinon because you're not going to get a base from which to do these studies. But since we know that when you have diazinon, which is an organophosphate insecticide, it attacks the central nervous system the same way as the other organophosphate insecticides, I believe it is reasonable to say, to draw on the other epi studies, to say that we can take the characteristics of these other insecticides, we can analogize them to this, and we can draw conclusions. Now again,
the objective conclusions of the expert is different than his methodology. But you're never going to have epi studies when you're dealing with an insecticide like this.
One problem, though, Havner is a no-evidence case.
Yes, Your Honor, Havner is a no-evidence case.
And one of the witnesses in this case, there were several, as you know, but Dr. Johnson, for example, he testified in a number of other cases, and there are half a dozen reported decisions, one of which we cited in Havner, that refused to give weight to his testimony. Does that play any part in our no evidence analysis or evidentiary analysis?
Your Honor, on the issue of causation, in this case, nothing has been preserved on that for you to consider. I don't think you can consider Dr. Johnson, what you just referred to, because they haven't preserved it. And I do not agree with them when they said that you have causation factors in liability and you have causation factors in damages. I think they are totally separate.
Well, for example, you've been alluding to Judge Gonzalez's comment that the moon is made of green cheese, testimony that the moon is made of green cheese, is no evidence that it is.
No.
Just not.
And
if you why isn't a sort of multi-court rejection of a witness testimony, not just in one place but across the country, why is that sort of like the moon is made of green cheese testimony?
I will answer your question, and I'd also point out that in Havner, Justice Owens said, you know, that unobjected to testimony does not necessarily make it reliable. But at some point, someplace in the trial, somebody has to preserve for review by this court something. Okay. And that was not done in this particular case. I don't think you can bootstrap the no evidence insufficiency on damages over to causation and liability. I just don't think you can do that. Let me point out in Havner, too. In Havner, there were more objections than a person would ever believe possible. They fought them on motion for summary judgment. They had a 702 hearing. They had numerous other hearings all throughout the case. They preserved error with their objections, motion for new trial. Every place, Havner preserved it. Here, it has not been preserved anywhere. And I do not agree that there, what they did do, regarding question 6 on their motion for JNOV, motion for new trial, I do not concur that that will allow anyone to boost it. The psychology that they used again and again in this case, I simply believe that they are not entitled. They don't have the right to ask to be bootstrapped up and to be helped. Cross-examination, according to Wigmore, is the greatest engine in searching for truth there is. They abandoned cross-examination. They abandoned every right and remedy. And now they want the court to save their apples. And I just don't think they can do it. I just don't think
it's
correct.
If they, I'm trying to think of something that helps me clarify this. The issue here is not that there was some injury. The issue is that some witnesses got up there to testify some additional injuries, and they're saying there's no evidence. Essentially, they're saying no evidence for that, but from the Jones Act case, they said there's not a featherweight amendment on this other injury, or I guess a preponderance of the evidence on this other injury. Seems to me to be like I'm somehow the expert who's testifying about the cost of repairs to an automobile that was in a car wreck, and it collapsed the front end of the car, and I give the cost to repair the car wreck, and, well, they also repaired the back end. Yes, I repaired the back end, and here's the cost of the back end. And there's no dispute that there was a wreck, and there's no dispute that it caused some damages to the car. When I come up and after the jury awards 100% of the cost to repair this automobile, I want to object to the trial court, wait a minute, there's no evidence, not factually sufficient evidence to establish that the back end of the car repairs were required because of this accident. Couldn't I do that without objecting to the repair? repair company's testimony, couldn't I call the court's attention that, wait a minute, I didn't object to him talking about the cost of repairs and all of this, but I do object after the testimony comes in when the jury awards 100% of the cost of repair that the evidence doesn't support that all of the damages was the result of this one accident. Couldn't I do that without objecting?
I understand your point, and what I'm saying is that I think in a federal substantive case like this, involving a featherweight burden of proof, to come in and set all these standards, that what you are doing is you're increasing Mr. Ellis's burden of proof under the Jones Act from a featherweight to a burden of proof that is far more significant.
Even under featherweight, wouldn't he have to tie in the repairs to this accident?
On causation, they haven't preserved anything. They're trying to bootstrap damages into a discussion of causation, and I don't think you can do that. I don't think, even liberally interpreting the rules, we will get to the point where their objections are any more than objections as to damages. Yes, Justice Bates.
The question about the featherweight burden is also one of their points of error, and they point out that the question number six is based upon proving by preponderance of evidence as opposed to how the question number one on causation was, in fact, a featherweight burden. Can an appellate court look at that question under some other standard other than what was submitted to the jury to decide, that is, preponderance of the evidence?
I'm not sure if I fully understand your question, Justice Baker.
Well, I seem to recall a line of cases that says if you submit a question to the jury, then you look at the evidence from the standpoint of the question the jury was answering from a preponderance of the evidence, rather than saying at a later time, oh no, you should look at it at a featherweight burden. That's what I'm getting at. Don't want you stuck with what you submitted to the jury.
I think you are stuck, but if I can read to you, the liability or causation issues were submitted twice. Here's the way. Question number one, was Maritime Overseas Corporation negligent on any part of the occasions in question, and did such negligence play any part, even the slightest, in producing the injury or illness to Richard Ellis?
But that was your issue.
Yes.
Which is a featherweight burden under the Jones Act.
Yes.
But your number six question is by preponderance of the evidence.
Yes.
Do you agree they're not the same?
Yes.
So now are you stuck with what you submitted when you look at their claims of excessive damages by preponderance of the evidence?
No.
Why not?
I think that question number six, it has its burden of proof, but I don't think you can do anything that goes back and change number one.
That's not my question. I understand what you're saying there, but when we look at their point of error, which is the $8 million plus is excessive, they say the Court of Appeals looked at it and used the wrong standard, and they're asking this court to send it back to look at it under what they say is the correct standard, whatever they may say it is.
I don't agree that on question number six there is any causation to tie back to. I think question number six is simply the money amount of the damages.
That's exactly what it says. We can't disagree with that.
Yes.
And I understand your argument to be that they're attempting to use the causation argument to overturn excessive damages.
Yes, which is a
remediator point. Just because they didn't preserve the causation issue. Is that right?
Yes.
And that's it? That's the bottom line?
They didn't preserve it.
What about the CompuGraphic case?
CompuGraphic is an interesting case, but it's a default judgment case, and I don't think it stands for what they cited for. It is a default judgment case, which is a totally different fact situation. My suggestion to the court, let me look this one second. In the note, they've admitted that we have damages. They've admitted it here. They've admitted it in their briefs. I think this admission is fatal. I think the proper disposition of the case is improvident grant and deny. Never have I seen a case where people ask the court to go to this link to save their bacon. Thank you for your time.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
please the court, I would like to start with reading a portion of the motion for new trial that Maritime filed timely with the trial court, very clearly pointing out to the trial court, in accordance with the State Department of Highways versus Payne, the basis for our error being that there was a lack of a causative element. This is at page 44, I believe, Your Honors, of the transcript, and I want to read section 1 that says the award is based on speculative evidence. Defendant does not dispute and has never disputed the fact that plaintiff was exposed to diazinon on board the Overseas Alaska and suffered some immediate or acute effects as set forth in, of the exposure. Plaintiff's recovery of actual damages and set forth in all of the subparts of question 6 must be predicated upon a determination that the jury, by the jury, that plaintiff was permanently and totally disabled from the exposure to diazinon. Plaintiff produced testimony from a toxicologist and a number of health care providers to the plaintiff, all of whom testified that plaintiff suffered from chronic neurotoxicity as a result of the exposure, which neurotoxicity caused permanent physiological damage to the nervous system and secondary psychological symptoms. All of the medical experts testified that plaintiff would experience temporary effects from the exposure to diazinon, which would resolve as the acetylcholinesterase levels in the body return to normal. Defendant concedes that plaintiff is entitled to damages consistent with exposure and short-term effects. Defendant would assert, however, that there is insufficient evidence upon which the jury could make the determination of permanent disability or permanent injury, and that such determination would be against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence.
Isn't that a causation assertion?
It absolutely is, Your Honor, of the causation portion of damages.
If it was this clear to you that they had a lay-down case on short-term damages, but no case on long-term, why didn't you ask for two separate damage injuries?
Because there was evidence, Your Honor. There's not a lay-down case, as I said. It's an insufficiency review, we believe, here. But the damage issue was submitted by the plaintiffs in this way.
Well, why didn't you object to, I mean, the Kavanaugh versus Quality Control, opposing counsel didn't object to not laying out the damages, but he lost it all.
Well, we certainly did believe, Your Honor, that there was some evidence of some damages, just not these damages.
But if they're clearly separable, as it, I mean, there's short-term, you get well, and then there's long-term damages, why didn't you ask for two damage lines? And do you run into some preservation problems in not doing that?
I don't think so, Your Honor, primarily because of the fact that the way the two issues are worded, one being, the question number one being, did it cause some injury, which is yes. Section 2 being, the second question, question 6 being, what were the injuries that actually resulted from that exposure? We believe the evidence supported some damage, but not years and years and years of...
So you agree that there is some evidence to support the answer to question 6?
There certainly would be evidence to support a 2 days' worth of loss of work, medical care for the acute effect.
So, bottom line is there's some evidence to support the answer to question 6, but your contention is there's not enough evidence, or maybe there's no evidence to support what appears to be the full scope of the award that was given.
Insufficient evidence to support the
award. If
you didn't object to that, how can we deal with it here?
But we did object to that, Your Honor. We objected to question number 6.
What was
asked for a remediator as well.
What was your objection to 6?
Our objection to number 6. Not an objection to the charge. We made no charge error on that basis. Our objection, timely brought before this court, was on a motion for new trial saying that the evidence supporting the answer to question number 6 was insufficient.
Let me try this one more time. Mm-hmm. If I don't get a good answer, I'll shut up. You have a case and you submit lost wages. Plaintiff has for lost wages. Defendant doesn't object. The defendant concedes there's evidence of past lost wages, but doesn't think there's any evidence of future lost wages. Do you have some obligation to object to that question in the form that it is and ask for two lines? Or can your argument that, well, if they gave so much damages, they must have given some future lost wages, and there is no evidence of that, can that buy you a new trial?
I think that probably would not be able to, Your Honor, under the case law that you cited. However, this was, I believe, is very distinguishable given the fact that there is some evidence of each and every element that was submitted on
the case. There'd be evidence of lost wages under my hypothetical.
I'm sorry. No, I mean in our case, there was evidence of lost wages. There was some evidence of lost wages. There was some evidence of medical expenses. There was some evidence of injury due to the short-term effects. I wanted to read a quote from the court's opinion in CompuGraphics, which I think is absolutely relevant to this.
My question, did you preserve a no evidence point?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did you preserve a no evidence point for appeal?
No, I do not believe. We did file a motion for new trial and for JNOB. However, I don't believe that we objected.
All your points of error are based on your motion for new trial.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that's all?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you did not preserve a no evidence point in your motion for new trial?
Let me take a look again.
I recall every one of them saying the damages are excessive.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's factually insufficient evidence to support the $8 million in damages.
Yes, our motion for judgment.
Is it correct? Your whole argument is about causation.
Our causation of damages, Your Honor.
No, you just think they're too much. And you argue there's no causation, is that right?
Well, it's not simply that there's just too much. It's the fact that the amount of damages.
But that's the only point you made. They are excessive, is what you said in your motion for new trial.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What you said in your motion for new trial is the damages are excessive.
Yes, Your Honor, they're excessive.
And we want a remittiture.
Well, it says more than that, the portion that
I read.
And
you want a new trial.
The portion that I read to the court talks about the lack of the causative link between these diazinon and the kinds of damages.
Based upon evidence admitted without objection.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
One quick question. Are you familiar with the U.S. Supreme Court case Antilles versus Inter-Caribbean Shipping Corporation?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
Does that case pose a problem for you all?
No, Your Honor, I really don't think it does, especially in light of the recent United States Supreme Court opinion in Metro North versus Buckley, which we cited to the court in our most recent supplemental brief. The site for that is 117 Supreme Court 2113.
What's the name of it again?
Metro North Computer Railroad Company versus Buckley, Your Honor, 117 Supreme Court 2113. In that case, the court looked to state common law in deciding not to allow a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress without evidence of a particular physical manifestation rather than psychological.
But that wasn't a Jones Act case.
Yes, Your Honor, it was a Vela case. It was a Vela case, and the court knows Vela and Jones Act use the exact same standard. In that case, the court held that courts like this court, in the absence of some sort of statutory provision in the Jones Act or Vela, excluding inquiries, that this court should look to common law to determine what the standards are going to be. Neither Jones Act nor FELA have any dictation of standard for appellate review of damage awards or on the burden of proof of proving damages. In that case, this court must look to the common law, which we've asked this court to do in Daubert in accordance with Daubert and Hess. Thank you very much.
Any other? Thank you. That concludes our arguments today, and all the foregoing clauses will be submitted on brief and oral argument. Marshall will adjourn the court.
All right.